Welcome to Blind Faith, a podcast exploring God and life in this world. I mean, thoughts about God and life in this world. That's okay. We keep it real. So we are here, and my name is Andy Opie, and today we've got with us Chandler, our producer, is on the mic this time.
Hello.
And we've got Salma.
What's up?
And so today, I don't know why this story was back in my mind, but I recently was telling my daughter this story when I was running a marathon the third time. So the first time I didn't finish, and so then I had this desire to, before I turn 30, I better run a marathon and finish, or I'll live to regret it for the rest of my life. So,
oh, wow.
So then I turned 30 the day after the LA marathon, and I won't tell you which year, but then I was in shape for marathons, and the San Diego Rock and Roll Marathon was only 3 months later in June. So I'm like, hey, my friend in church where I was that we ran together, let's stay running and we'll do that one too, which was way more fun because every mile a random cover band was playing music. And so
that's pretty cool.
So in running, we joined a different running group in Orange County to just stay in shape for that marathon. And you work your way up over time to running 20 or 22 miles. And then you taper off over a couple weeks. So then you're ready for 26 miles, which is ridiculous because the first guy that ran a marathon, who it's named after, or not named after him, but named after the city where he ran from or to, he collapsed and died. So
what?
The Greek legend of the guy, and he's running to like bring news to protect people from a ensuing war. So maybe he didn't train, and that's different. But then we're, wow, like, hey, we're human. Let's do this and let's make records based off. So I'm running, and this really internally conflicted. I'm doing this thing that people died. The original guy died, but I'm running, and now we're on this 20-mile run from some point in Dana Point, then through some bike trail off to some other way and circle back around. So it's about 10 and 11 mile, like one direction, then circle back.
Wow.
And part of this is on this bike trail that then in one place goes through a small tunnel that goes under a road or under train tracks, I forget. And so we're running, and this friend of mine, Joe, is running with me, and we would run near each other, and I just listen to his voice because we're in an open trail, so I'm not afraid of curbs usually. There's other stories with Joe, but yeah, we'll leave those for another time. But so we're in an open bike trail, so I'm good running next to him, and he says, oh, Andy, there's a bike coming at us.
Oh no.
Yes. Oh no. and so then I'm thinking, all right, Joe maybe wasn't always the quickest at giving description of which way to go. So now there's a bike coming.
Oh no. Oh no.
And so I'm thinking, I better react sooner than later. So I start going left, and I think Joe had said it's coming. So, and he might even said move. And so I start moving left. Well, the bike saw me running in the left side of the trail, and Joe was on the right side. So the bike, was starting to move more to my left to get around us, but I started moving to the left.
Oh no. Oh no.
You see where it's going. And so then Joe's like, no, no, come back this way. So then I move back towards the middle of the bike trail. Well, the bike had already seen me go out to the outside of the trail, and I'll go between these two people.
Oh no. Oh,
and
no.
I come back, and now there's no more time to adjust, and he just nails me straight on.
Oh. Wait, what mile were you on? Do you remember?
Probably around 10 at this point.
You're halfway through? No.
Maybe not. Maybe 8, no. somewhere between a third and halfway. We hadn't yet turned back around. And so, like, I played football in high school, so it just felt like just getting drilled by a linebacker. Oh. And going completely backwards.
Ow.
Landing on my bottom, just maybe even skipping on the asphalt. But I don't remember exactly how dramatic my fall was. I just remember, like, running and suddenly going backwards in the air and then hitting the ground. Thankfully, ow, I didn't hit my head or anything.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Chandler's like, yeah. So it was clearly, oh no. And avoidable in many ways, but not because, because I went one way and he was trying to go around me and I went the other way. And so imagine he doesn't see a cane. He doesn't know that he hit a blind person. He probably thinks he's some guy's messing with him. And then it just went, this whatever prank went terribly wrong.
Oh, no.
So he quickly is off his bike, and one, he doesn't want to have hurt his bike, and two, what is this guy doing? that made him crash into somebody. So he is like livid and starts like, I'm like just trying to get my bearings. I was not,
yeah,
my head wasn't hurt. Like I knew where I, like I knew what just happened, but I was just like, where am I on the ground? And I'm just, and he's yelling and I'm like ignoring him cause I'm getting my bearings. And then my friend Joe is like, he's blind. He can't see. So suddenly there's a shift in the like moment. And he went from being super mad, like yelling at me like, why did you do that? You could have broke my bike or whatever he was yelling in language that we don't want on the podcast maybe. But he, he was super mad to then super like, uh-oh, I don't want to get in trouble for hurting a person who's blind. And then was very apologetic.
Oh,
like, wow. Oh no, what did I do wrong? And I'm thinking, well, none of us did anything particularly wrong. Maybe there should be a bigger sign on me, or maybe my, you know, this could have happened to prevent it. This, but I'm like, no, I don't, like, I'm okay. I've been hit hard before. And like, he hit me just right that it didn't, like, it got me in a way that didn't hurt more than it could have. And so it's like, yeah, maybe bruise my bottom, but not, I'm more like, I don't want to miss these next 12, 14 miles. I got to finish this.
Yeah, I was going to ask, did you end up finishing the half marathon?
Well, I mean, that 20 miles I did finish that day. I was like, I just got to get up and keep running. I don't want to lose our friends that just kept going. No, I don't think anybody kept going. They all were watching. They were all watching the scene. But in my mind, I'm like, dude, just don't be mad and keep going. I'm going to keep going. Hope your bike's not hurt. I hope I'm not hurt. Let's just dust myself off and keep going. And but it's one of those moments that I look back and I'm like, what was he thinking when he's seeing this guy totally like messing with him? I'm going this way. Going he's going that way. Ways. And then I'm going the other way just in time to get in front of you. Like, oh, what must have been going through his mind? What? And then suddenly there's this drastic shift from like being super mad to being super like apologetic.
That's hilarious. That's very unfortunate though, but glad you're okay. I'm glad that you ended up finishing the marathon.
There was a lot of years that was a great sermon illustration on pressing on in Philippians 3 and to finish the race or whatever, all that
yeah.
stuff. I mean, now it's 20 years later, or not, whatever, 15 years later, it's not as fun of a story to overtell, but I mean, it's a funny story, but it doesn't always work its way into sermon illustrations anymore. But it was a funny story in the moment. Like, if you think about it objectively, like if somebody's filming it, it would have been hilarious on YouTube. But
but missed then, opportunity.
Yeah, but it does help us as we think about issues of disability. There's times where like certainly something preventable could have been done, but it's in the moment hard to know how to put blame on one or another. Maybe Joe was the one at fault. We'll just say Joe. And when you hear
thanks,
this,
Joe,
when you hear this, Joe, I know, you know, and I know your wife knows and every, like, so
that so, he's to blame.
Well, they would,
you know, this, your wife knows this.
That
now no. The podcast knows it.
No, the
point, our audience.
The point is, it's easy. It's probably always easier to blame somebody or something.
Yeah.
But sometimes stuff just happens.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And so it's how do we live in this world where there is there are moments that we can stop and go, oh, maybe this is a learning experience, more than saying, oh, this is something we need to fix.
Yeah, that's good.
I feel like I just listened to a sermon right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
And so maybe with that, we can transition to our special guest that we have today. We have Tom Reynolds joining us, Dr. Reynolds, who teaches in Toronto. And we'll
I was stuck in a labyrinth, called it a palace. He brought me out and gave me eyes to see all my lonely towers.
Let's welcome Tom Reynolds to the podcast, and just we're really, really grateful that you are with us, Tom.
No, thanks for inviting. Good to be with you.
And let me introduce Tom for those that don't know who he is. Tom, I got familiar with him in his work, Vulnerable Communion, which is a fascinating book that I thoroughly enjoyed, and I especially enjoyed Amos Young's blurb. When he said that this book challenges power that's, and I forget exactly how it was said, but power that's inherent in the way we do theology, and the we is, you know, whatever that means. But, and I, after reading the book, I agree wholeheartedly. And then, and Tom currently is, directs the graduate studies program, with one of the colleges there at, University of Toronto in the consortium in the, Toronto Theological School. And he's currently working on, a book related to disability care, theology of care, and I think that's fascinating. So maybe, when that's around, we can circle back and have a second conversation with him on things that he's, discovered there. And then, just for fun, I want to mention that he works with, or music is a big part of his life. It's a nourishing, spiritual aspect of his life. He plays at church, but also part of a jazz band, and just enjoys the art of writing and playing music.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks again for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation, Andy.
Yes. So we're super excited to have you with us on the podcast today. And typically how we kind of start all of our conversations is just by asking whoever we're interviewing, how did you get into disability theology? Is there a story there? Do you have a personal connection? Would just love to hear more background information about that.
Yeah. Thanks for that question. And there is a story. And it's sort of got multiple, it's like many streams, but the biggest stream is I was teaching at a Catholic school, and I was teaching undergrad, and there was a required course in theology, and I found myself teaching things one day that did not square with my experience and love for my child who is diagnosed on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. My spouse and I, through the years, were advocates and, you know, through various education programs and all sorts of social skill building things. But I had not thought through what it might mean to think theologically as a way of opening up the imagination of the church to be more robustly inclusive and accommodating and building communities of access in a more, you know, thorough way. Mm-hmm. And so I just realized, oh my goodness, I have to rethink everything in light of the love I have for my kid, because that's the most real thing for me. And I hadn't really done it. We had experiences in churches in various places that weren't positive. We were asked to leave one. I tell that story a little bit in the beginning of Vulnerable Communion, because of behavioral challenges. Mm. And it's like, or else other churches where either me or my spouse had to be downstairs during the service because no one was willing or there wasn't any care for children. And so church became a difficult thing for us. Yeah. And so we stopped going until in Green Bay, where the school, St. Norbert College, was. It was a Presbyterian church. It was incredibly welcoming. And the disruptions were actually seen as invitations. So that's why disruptions are often invitations and often ways of participating, but they're often stigmatized and seen as problems to be solved or things to be shunned or excluded. So all these things kind of converged at the same time.
Wait, and I want to pause there for a second. Disruptions, yeah. I want to unpack that a moment. Disruptions are often invitations, but also some view disruptions as things to be solved, and so there's a almost even two sides of the coin to that word disruptions. So I'm very curious to hear more on that.
Yeah, well, it's in some cases, because disability is not just about the body gone wrong, so to speak, but it's often stigmatized as a flaw of the person. Disability is about barriers in a community that prevent full participation and leadership by and for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so disruption might actually be a kind of prophetic call for the community to change.
Wow.
It might actually be a way
no,
in the case.
No, tell me, no, the community would need it. No, don't make us change. We're not the problem.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, and a lot of places that's the case, because ableism, I call it, you know, normalcy. Things are status quo, and oh yeah, don't ask us to change. Hospitality is like, come inside, but don't ask us to rearrange the furniture or do anything.
Oh no, I need to, because being blind, that sparks a whole host of stories, yeah. But also people think it's funny sometimes, be like, oh, what happens if we move the furniture, or what happens if we, and I will just, one funny story. So I don't think it's always, I mean, it depends who's saying the joke and where the context is, whether they're being funny or rude. But one of the funniest moments, one of the funniest moments was, I was sitting in a particular seat on a Sunday morning church service, and I got up because I needed to handle something outside related to whatever ministry I was involved with. And I come back in, but the ushers, not remembering that I was sitting there, helped a visiting family sit in that row. And so I come back, and people who knew where I was sitting saw it coming in slow motion that I was about to sit on this lady but nobody else knew how to stop it, because it's not like, it's in their minds, it's happening in slow motion, but nobody knows, do I jump and intervene? Do I let it happen? Do we say something and interrupt the sermon? You know, and so, yeah, that's an example of disruption. And when you say, come into the house, but don't ask me to rearrange the furniture or whatever. And sometimes people rearrange the furniture because they're fixing something. Or even at this campus, the maintenance was fixing something that the ladder was on the stairs. And so I'm walking down the stairs near where the office is, and I'm like, what? Why is there a ladder? I almost walked into the ladder, but thankfully I didn't. And then I ask, like, hey, can somebody tell the maintenance and not just leave the ladder by itself? And then I come back an hour later, and then it's moved. And I come back an hour later, it's there again without anybody there. I'm like, they really are trying to get me hurt, I think. But so, yeah, don't ask me to rearrange the furniture, or think about who might not be, like, who might get tripped up by the furniture this way, or who might get excluded because of the furniture this way. So that's a really good analogy with hospitality.
Yeah, that's a great example, because communities get set up in ways that, my language is with a restrictive imagination, with low or no expectations that any body would show up that differs from an expected norm. That's really problematic in a church where, you know, 1 Corinthians 12, many members with many kinds of bodies. Yeah. So that are joined in Christ. And so this is a case in point. And so often it's the faith communities that are problems and not the person. So
at lunch, I was talking with a couple in our church who, one is a principal in an elementary school and the other works in the, towards being a superintendent in a school district, but they were asking me about issues of accessibility, and then they're asking me about the church, and I'm like, well, let's have that conversation. I'm in conversation with the pastor. Let's have that in due time. But what I did say is, why is it like the school, even where the school systems fall short in accessibility, the schools in the U.S. are way ahead of where we are as churches. And I just left it at that. Like, why? Like, so you're talking about how, as faith communities, we have a restricted imagination. I love that language.
Yeah, well, and it's like, well, for example, to see building communities that are accessible and accommodating, where people with disabilities can be participant and actually provide leadership, it's seen as, well, resource drain or a program to start instead of an integral part of the church's ministry and mission.
Oh, wow.
I've seen over and over again that, well, we built an accessible ramp at the back door. you know, well, the symbolism of that is pretty big. And secondly, it's like, well, disability is varied. It's like, there's not just one kind. What are you going to do to half your congregation that has trouble hearing a sermon because of hearing difficulties? You know, so it's, yeah, that's the restrictive imagination is like, are we paying attention? And is our theology framed in such a way that it actually helps foster more barriers? So that's, I mean, I wrote the book.
Oh,
to
no.
Kind of read
does it foster more barriers? Okay.
Yeah.
Just don't ask us these questions. They're too uncomfortable.
Yeah. And for me, too, because I had to rethink, well, what does it mean to be a parent?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Get back to your story. So, yeah, please unpack that.
Oh, no, that's okay. I had to. So this book was really for me. And I thought, no, nobody's going to read it. And then I met Amos Young, who was writing his book to honor his brother with Down syndrome. And we read drafts of the books for each other. And I realized, wow, maybe there's something important here. But I needed to rethink it. And I was hoping faith communities, it could be a part of retooling our theology to not think of bodies in one sort of way, especially the image of God, you know, as rational, autonomous kinds of things that just perpetuate the myth of normalcy and the ableism that accompanies it. So, yeah, I was rethinking because I failed a lot in the case of being a good parent, because I was like, well, no, you know, mainstreaming is important because we've got to get this child on track so they're not left. But, well, what if there's a different
on
style?
Track to what?
Exactly. On track to what? To the sort of normal idea? Well, what's that really? What is normal? So I started, yeah, rethinking everything. And
I know why that book meant a lot to me, but I don't know why that word normal, even as a seventh grader, when I was in one of those, because self-esteem classes were a thing back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I forever have been like, what is normal? And that was before I lost my eyesight and asked what is normal in light of ableism. But what is normal? Like, as a seventh grader, I know I wasn't normal then. And so what does it mean to be normal? That's such a, and we'll get there some more with, when we ask about your book there. But yeah, keep going with telling us about the questions that arose as you're parenting your son.
Yeah, well, just all the things that I needed to rethink. And one of them was how we talk about suffering. And is disability about suffering only? And questions of the technical term is theodicy, like why does God permit suffering? And I realized, and others like John Swinton have written on this, and I realized how wrong directional that is. That leads to questions that don't attend to the person, but rather solve problems. And that just fits into the whole idea of disability as something to be solved. And so it was that day, it was on theodicy, and I was, you know, there are various models and so forth. And I realized, actually, you know, protest might be the best. Job actually questions God, and the Psalms question God. Maybe lament has a role to play. And more than that, even for me, it was, how can I express loving God who's present in my kid as Christ is present? And so that to me got me thinking about incarnation, got me thinking about, well, the last three chapters have a Trinitarian structure. It got me really thinking theologically about what it means to be in relation. And I guess if there's a key piece of that, that human being is a relational being down to the core. Being human isn't a substantive norm. It's not a substance that's static. It's being human is a verb, a process that we do with one another. And we work out the image of God in relationships that are vulnerable, that in fact, it's no accident that the reign of God is a community. It's a kinship. It's a household of God. It's a, you know, a place of relationality. And so
I want to slow you down right there, because I think Chandler and Solomon have a question related. You said the reign of God, and we talk about this in our Pentecostal ethos as a as a school, that's a Pentecostal school, the reign of God, the kingdom of God. And you just mentioned a number of things that it is. And so I want to just slow down a second to see if I can, and if I can prompt Chandler or Salma to maybe probe that question a little more.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting you talked about, and just you've been like emphasizing how like we're relational beings, how we're meant to kind of function in relationship with one another and like, of course, in relationship to God. But even you like said a statement that that we kind of work out how we're the image of God in relationship to one another. And I just thought that was really powerful because I think whenever I think of the image of God, I think of like me personally and okay, how am I embodying this image of God? How am I embodying him? And sometimes it doesn't even go to the relational level. And so I just thought that was really interesting. And also you talked about how like all this language of kind of like God's reign, like it is language of like, it's a kinship, you know, like it is a family. And I just thought that was really interesting. I've never really, it's one of those things I think that you always hear, but when you really, just take a moment to just sit and just think about it, it does kind of, yeah, that's just really interesting to me. So.
Hmm. Yeah. It helps me think about what it means to be church.
Yeah.
You know, Paul's language in Ephesians, household of God, which is a kind of foretaste of the kingdom.
Yeah.
And the language of kinship is there too. It's a way of being together in the Spirit through Christ. Yeah. And that's a pretty powerful model to think about. We actually are completed by one another, ultimately by God, but in relationships with one another, we're porous, we're vulnerable, not just to suffering, but to the joy we encounter with one another. And I had been duped.
Go ahead. You were saying.
I
love it. I don't want to cut you off there. You're duped. You're duped. I was about to say something, but now I'm curious what you're saying.
Oh, I was duped by this myth of autonomy that somehow we're rational, self-interested subjects that the European Enlightenment sort of goes and that to be fully alive means to be an agent that's, you know, productive and efficient and all the kind of hyper-capitalist modern norms.
Yeah.
And I realized, wow, that's how I'm parenting. Mm-hmm. I'm parenting so my kid gets framed this way, which is not at all about his way of being. So soon as I could, and I, you know, it's not like my journey's done. So I don't want to say, yes, and now everything's good. But to put aside this desire that I have to be efficient, that I have to be productive, and that my kid does too, and has to conform to what expectations are there often put by a society that's bent on sort of hyperspeed and, you know, efficiency and also parenting in just the right way. So if you fail, oh no, it's because I'm going to have to take risks. And that's part of being together in a community and in relationships. So
yeah.
That's what I meant by duped. Sorry.
I love it. Thank you for listening to Blind Faith. Now, a word from our sponsor. Are you ready to hear who's sponsoring this podcast?
Yes. Yeah.
Have you ever been to the Mall of America?
No.
Have you ever wanted to be the Mall of America?
No.
Yes. Oh.
Okay, one yes, one no. But what if I told you DeLeo Brothers Pizza? Okay.
I changed my answer.
One of the best pizzas in all of Minnesota, as voted by the people that vote for that. And here's their slogan: in garlic, we crust.
Oh.
Now you want to go to the Mall of America, don't you?
I'm going to the Mall of America right now.
Let's take a flight.
And they have a second location opening in Seattle. So look it up on this thing called Google. And DeLeo Brothers Pizza, bringing you Blind Faith Podcast. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Chandler, as you're hearing about the kingdom of God, the kinship, the reign of God, you've got thoughts. Go for it, Chandler.
Yeah, no, I think that I've just been sitting here like, wow, no, like this is like absolutely wrecking me, because I think that oftentimes I'm thinking like I just graduated from life here, and I'm kind of thinking about myself going into ministry and kind of like how I'm sitting here wrestling with, like, I have these blind spots. Like,
how can I get married if I'm not making enough money? I'm sorry. Wait.
There it is.
Bri is not calling me. I'm sorry. That just was my own.
Is she in your ear right now?
Yeah.
Aww. Yeah. That's real too, but yes.
Do you have answers for that? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, three easy steps.
Yeah. But you know, I think kind of my thought is like, and I imagine like the conversation would have got into here, but kind of what I was thinking is like, what are ways that we can like be actively engaging to kind of eliminate these blind spots that maybe we don't even know that we have?
Yeah, there's so many things that we could be doing, but part of it, building accessible communities is accessible by and with, and who's not there and why, asking those kind of questions and even more, who's where, who's on the margins and and asking the question so that access is an ongoing task, not just a box to check, but access is ongoing for all. And that shifts, of course, as members flow in and out. But I'm thinking congregationally here, but and communities. But being attentive to those kinds of things is part of that. Also, I mean, I said tweaking our theological imagination. We can get into that more. But even sort of riffing on these points more, it's watching our language and watching how we organize space together.
Say that language. What, for example?
Language of deafness as a moral failure. So there's that's used in scripture, but there are ways of reading scripture that can push against disabling reading of that, or blindness as a moral failure, or any kind of blemish, so-called, that would be deemed by a community that Paul talks about. You know, all members have gifts, and it's the Spirit that gives gifts, not one another. It's the Spirit that opens us up, and so there's ways to adjust how language works. And one of the scariest words that we often use is we. Like, who is we? Who's us? And
we in the United States have a Declaration of Independence that says we, and somehow means all, and then yet we can ask a question when we do this Pledge of Allegiance that we have in this country, liberty and justice for all, and all doesn't always mean all. So, we is a very dangerous word.
Yeah.
And so it's being, I guess, open to and attentive, and part of that for me is humility.
Oh, that's good.
And a willingness to risk failure. But humility that we're not complete in ourselves.
Yeah.
Even when we do all we can do, there's more that can be done, and no one's complete in themselves, and we need each other, and ultimately God, who completes beyond the wildest anticipations of what we might be. I don't know if that made sense, but so it's those kinds of things for me that are part of communities. And sometimes I'll do workshops in churches and develop sort of different, like, listening groups. Disability audits, inviting people, everybody present, to talk about, you know, where the space, because space is often organized in ways that really do have barriers. Attitudes are barrier too, but spaces,
I want to come to that. I've been wanting to come to that for a few moments. I was just in by the time this comes out, it'll be a little bit later in chronological order. As we're recording this, I was recently in Finland for the Pentecostal World Conference. And so since you teach mission, maybe you'll have something to say to this. It wasn't so different, as I understand, how Lausanne 4, which 50 years after Lausanne 1, very American-centric and very, the word hubris comes to mind. We can finish the task. And so I want to be generous, because Rick Warren, I think, can easily be critiqued, but also I think he's also served in the way that he feels God has led him to serve. So I want to be generous and not just criticize him in any way as a person or as a minister, but some of the language that he uses, maybe his disciples or the people who buy into this seeker sensitive model. Yeah. I mean, that's not his wording, but purpose driven church. And so he's there, and I'm like hearing him say the same things I heard him say when I was a student, reading his books. So it's not like, but, and he talks about mission a lot, and he's part of Billy Graham's Finishing the Task Foundation, whatever they call it now. It's not foundation, but so he's there, and in a Pentecostal thing, and Ed Setzer's there, and I thought, wow, this is a very Baptist thing, even if they are charismatic in some way, or I mean, Rick Warren says he's Pentecostal, so whatever all that means, but finishing the task, that language, or purpose-driven church, Saddleback church, which down the street from where we are, and I lived in that community when it was a young church. But my professor of whatever church health, whatever, when I was a student, he was planting a church here just down the road, Glendora, California. And so he copied the same language as Saddleback Sam. Let's build a church for Saddleback Sam. Who is Saddleback Sam? He's a suburban working class, what back then it might have been a yuppie, young or whatever, professional something. And like, who is this person? They're young, mobile, mother, father, they have kids. Let's have a really dynamic kids ministry. We'll pour money into it so it looks like this. And so then this church in the 90s in Glendora, they had, well, who's Glenn and who's Dora? That's a prototypical person. And then it comes back to your language of normalcy. So we're building a church around so-called normal people who can come in efficiently, send their kids to the Sunday school. We'll take care of them over there. We'll preach to them. And 65, 75 minutes later, we'll send them out. And another set of people come in and go out. Mm-hmm. And we've created church for the efficient ways that we can grow it quickly. And I don't want to, I mean, it served a particular kind of people. So it's not all bad. But what did that create as everybody else copied this model that maybe was contextual for a particular moment in time? And then we talk in the language of efficiency. We can finish the task in this Pentecostal thing. We're going to do it in 8 years because I don't know why, but 8 years is supposedly 2033 in their mind is 2000 years from when Christ was crucified and risen. And so we can do it. And so this hubris of we have money and we have vision and we have people. So we can do it. And so I just keep hearing this language, we've been saying that since 1888. We can evangelize the world in our generation. So what now? We're even closer to finishing it, but maybe not. So this language of efficiency is all throughout the way we think of church planting or mission or whatever language we want to put to that. I'd like you to speak to that. I know I rambled, but.
No, that's, I think you've pointed to a huge issue in how churches think of themselves as being, in some sense, participating in God's mission. And I think there's a great quote that I'm not sure I'm going to get it right. But often churches think they have a mission of God in the world, but actually it's a God of mission that has churches in the world. And the churches themselves think they're the center and it's their timeline, not God's. But, you know, however many years, that's God. And sometimes God works slow.
Yeah.
God's patient. And that language.
No, but we're in a hurry. Even if Second Peter says God is waiting for the right time to come back again, that as many people will hear and turn it. And then when people tell me, I'm praying for Jesus to come back. And I say to them, well, are you also praying for this many people to go to hell because you want Jesus to come back tomorrow or today? But we have this sense of, God, come to me now. I need you now. And this hurry or the urgency in our eschatology that's like, he's coming back any second, so we better do it or else we're not saving people.
Well, it fits in a certain sense with a self-serving spirituality where it's really kind of all about me.
Wow.
Instead of, God, what would you have me do in the world to prepare the way?
Yeah.
It's, God, hurry up for me. And that kind of fits into the individualism a little bit that I mentioned, that, you know, it's about making sure my way and my path is easy and smooth. And the way may be challenging, but it's God's plan.
Yeah.
Certainly I can make choices and discern where the spirit is moving so that I'm aligned with, but in my own spiritual journey, there's a depth in the waiting and pausing. And I find that actually fits with how sometimes people receive disability as a problem to be solved.
Wow.
Instead of pausing, and waiting in silence and being attentive is like, well, what can I do? Because I'm uncomfortable. You know, I fear failing. I don't know what to do here. Instead of, you know, calmly waiting and discerning what might be going on and risking being attentive. So as you're talking there, I'm thinking, there's a very shallow sense of mission at work there. Instead of God's mission in the world. And there's the theme, the Latin is Missio Dei, that became big in the mid-20th century.
Yeah.
Ben Connor talks about it in his book on disability and mission, which I'd recommend. But it's a larger project than mine or any church's. It's God's project in the world.
Yeah.
So,
Well, it does sometimes feel like we own the gospel and the power of the gospel is ours. And we possess it, and then we use it to assault people with it. So maybe that's a little overstatement, but I think we would do well to remember who the power belongs to, and who owns the gospel, and who owns the story and how it unfolds. And I don't want to get so far into like, okay, sovereignty and we do nothing, but I think we lean too far the other direction sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, there's a way, the language, we participate in God's mission. And that's an active sense of doing.
Yeah.
But that doing sometimes is pausing and waiting and building communities of access and the kind it may mean just being silent and listening to others, making connections and bridging isolated people who are on the margins and being conduits of care and resilience. Maybe that's doing the work of God and not adventure seeking, whatever. expansion that's like this huge project.
We've mentioned a number of things that kind of hint at the one of the main words in your work, vulnerable communion. We've hinted at people on the margins or people that are neglected and so on. But I'd really love for you to unpack the word vulnerable. I mean, maybe I'm putting you on the spot since you define it so well in the book, but just unpack that word if you want to get back into the etymology as you do in the book, but unpack it so we as just everyday people can understand what you mean by using that word.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting now. There's a whole field called vulnerability studies, and there's ethics of vulnerability. So this is after I wrote the book.
Because when I came to your work shortly after reading Brené Brown, Dare to Be Vulnerable, and I feel like she's a beautiful writer, but I felt like she's using vulnerability to then subvert something else, but she's trying to say vulnerability has a place of power in it. And then what you were doing in your work was addressing the reality that vulnerability is not always something to be like daring to be vulnerable. And so I think there was a value to what Brené Brown did, but I think what you brought out is something more attuned to the reality of vulnerability.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a kind of human condition of being, well, vulnerably embodied, entangled with others. We need each other to become ourselves. We're interrelated from the start. And I like the word porous, you know,
mm-hmm.
we're subject to harm by others, to be sure, which is the Latin, you know, to be harmable. But we're also subject to being influenced into joy, and growing into beautiful things. That's a basic sense of vulnerability. And I think of like fragile earthen vessels, you know, as Paul talked about. But then vulnerability is distributed differently. Some people, some bodies are made more vulnerable than others by the way relationships and space and society is set up. And it's that kind of vulnerability that I think needs to be addressed. And for me, it's becoming aware of our more basic vulnerability as human beings that we can then critique the ways that our pretense to autonomy, to have it all under control, is actually what sin is about.
Wow.
And, you know, and
that, oh my goodness,
structures that create structures that hurt people and that distance us from God. So that's the kind of thing I was trying to do in my book, is use vulnerability as a way of talking about a basic human condition, but then how opening to that creates dispositions that can be transformative in a way to critique where some bodies are made more vulnerable than others and marginalized, but also address it and make changes in our communities and society.
Wow.
I feel like I'm a recovering hypocrite when it comes to wanting to let go of control. There's many times I love being in the mess and letting things go where they go, and knowing that that's the way of Jesus calling us to let go. And I don't want to be trite, let go and let God, that's not the point, but that you said it. So, but then I find myself when I'm getting stressed, getting cranky at my kids or my wife, or getting cranky at something. And that's a really understated way to say I'm being super rude and wanting to like get things controlled because I'm a recovering perfectionist. And so wow. Oh, yeah. I'm glad you said that. And maybe as you talk about vulnerability, Chandler or Salma might have some thoughts to help us unpack that a little bit.
Well, before you go on, I just want to say, I never have that problem. Yeah.
Somebody doesn't.
I'm with you there, Andy. Yeah. Control is, well, and we can talk about it later and I'll be quiet then. But the journey living with depression and anxiety disorder myself and learning about that in my relationship with my kids and family, I've learned who I am, and I've learned that the desire for control actually comes from a deep-seated insecurity.
Yeah.
Not being okay and beloved by God. So it's part of my spiritual journey. But
we want to hear from you. We do want to hear from you. That's the reason we're here.
Yeah.
No, Chandler, there was a question and
it's really cool. You kind of said something, how we have this desire to kind of be autonomous, which when you think about that, really it's being apart from God, and how really that's the root of sin. I don't think I ever thought of it in that way. So even when you said that, I think we all gasped in the podcast studio. So that was just so great. Just a great way. That was just a really great statement that you made. And then even just talking about vulnerability, I mean, I think for me, like my first instinct when I hear that word is kind of like, in some ways it can kind of be a little scary to hear that word. It can kind of feel a little bit uncomfortable. But then also I think of even like in my own relationship with the Lord, like the most beautiful moments I've had with him has been when I've been vulnerable. And I've just stood before him or sat before him and just kind of poured my heart out. And then even in other relationships, that a lot of times the most beautiful moments, I think the most life-giving fruit comes out of those vulnerable moments. And so, yeah, it was just really cool, honestly, to hear you unpack it. And I feel like it just gave me new perspective on it. So.
Yeah, you say that beautifully, because often it's very scary. And I feel like, well, the word that comes to my mind is ashamed before God for who I am. And I feel exposed and ashamed. And it's that fear then of judged and being excluded that sort of shores up my boundaries, and I guard myself and I protect against any kind of sense of that I'm not worthy, when there's a basic sense of that. And it's really interesting, and I you know, there were great theologians, Augustine and Luther, who talked about all this, and I mentioned it some in my book. But
we will judge if they're great later. But
Luther has a phrase is for sin, and he uses it in Latin, but the sense is desire curved in on itself.
Yeah.
Desire that curves in to protect itself rather than desire that extends outward to others and God ultimately.
Wow.
So it's like, wow, that is in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fear of vulnerability produces a desire to make sure I shore all my boundaries up to make sure I'm not porous.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
and I become the control freak I can be.
we all can.
But, you know, it's interesting because as a jazz musician,
It's
the messiness and lack of control that's where vibrancy happens in the music.
Wow.
Really interesting.
Yeah, speak to that, Chandler. You play some music. Or enjoy music.
Oh yeah, I love music. I got to be part of the Worship Arts and Media program here, and I love music. Not to backtrack though, but I did have something kind of as we kind of talk about vulnerability and trust. I kind of always have had the issue where I'm always trying to think my way out of these situations, and I feel like could you speak to like more like. When it looks like being vulnerable or like wanting to trust God rather than having our own autonomy, like what that actually like looks like. Cause I think that it's like, I reach a place a lot of times where like, Lord, I want to be vulnerable before you, or I want to trust you more. And I kind of want to let go. But then I kind of sit there and I'm like, well, what do I really mean by that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it may seem different to different people. And, you know, I'm tempted to sort of, at the theologian that I am, is outline criteria for discernment. In doing that, it may prevent the very personal thing that happens. And which is why I think being in communion, like vulnerable communion with others, is so important, because it's in relationships with others that I discover where I'm a little off track, and where my own journey with God and with others may be in need of tweaking.
Yeah.
But I do especially in the mornings, because depression, sort of the way it looks for me, is it's hard to move into a day without dread. And so prayer sometimes just means sitting there waiting.
Yeah.
Sometimes you call it mindfulness. I call it waiting. Where I empty myself, I think of my breath, and I ask, where is God? And that's just a practice that I have. Others do have different things, but
I ask, where is my news app? And then I want to know. I want to know what to be afraid of. By
well, that's true too. It's tempting to do that in the morning for me, but that's a bad thing for me.
Me too. Me too. It's not a very good spiritual practice. It's not a good spiritual practice to go to the news right after or before my other devotional practices.
Yeah.
Sorry, but, I mean, you were saying something.
That's a really great question, and I'm not sure I'm answering it fairly, but I do think it might be different for different people, and it's the relationships in our communities where we might get signs of where that may need to tweak itself a little more, where God's working, actually, to speak in that language.
I love that so much. I think that thinking about it's like, I think even better, like as we engage in our communities and press into them more, I think that opens up so many ways that we're not continuing to just seek after like there's a one size fits all answer.
Wow.
But instead there's a way, and we're engaging both with a community striving after an infinite God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. And it's like, And the relational piece too in that is always shifting and changing. It's like we improvise together and hear the music of God. And as we move forward, and there's a story about Herbie Hancock, who's a great jazz pianist.
Oh yeah, Herbie Hancock. Yeah, I like him. Mm-hmm.
He tells a story where he was playing one night and the band was cooking, and he suddenly hits in his mind a horrible wrong chord. And he made a judgment about the chord being wrong, terrible, sense of shame, and was embarrassed, and he thought he ruined the music. But what happened next taught him a deep lesson. Miles heard it and played a note that made that chord right. And the music took off in a new and exciting direction.
Wow.
So where I feel my failures are, along with others, may actually be invitations to new ways of being, new ways of risking being together. So as a teacher once said to me, maybe there's no wrong notes, just...
I love jazz as a metaphor, so in terms of theology, so much more than Kevin Van Hooser, who taught at where I did my PhD.
Oh, yeah, no. I love his stuff.
But his metaphor is the drama and the theater, which has its place, but I love the improvisational aspect of theologizing that allows us to adapt one to another as opposed to playing the role exactly as it, and I know I'm overstating what theater is, but like theater has a shortcoming in the way that we understand that analogy, that jazz allows for a little bit more fluidity to interpretation and hermeneutic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course there are limits, and improvisation isn't just a free-for-all, so it's learning the artistry of it in community, and riffing with the tradition, so to speak. And yeah, I don't want to go too far down that direction, but for me, it's a helpful metaphor.
Yeah.
You're right.
Any metaphor can go too far. So maybe that's true. So then we can criticize your metaphor now on the other side. But in terms of vulnerability, and I think of when you're talking about how to let go and how to, and this ongoing process, and I think of this, the meaningfulness of this famous hymn, "I Surrender All." And anytime it comes on, I start to then say this thing that I once said, like, okay, I did this once before, God, why am I doing it? And I realize, oh, there's other things now that I need to surrender that I didn't even know about. And I keep wanting to just say, haven't I surrendered it all to you yet, God? Why am I singing this song again? And it's always meaningful every new time I sing it. It's just meaningful in a new way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that's what we are before God, in that infinite journey into the infinite depth of God, a journey together of surrender, but not surrender in a sense of letting everybody else just do whatever, but a surrender of, I mean, you it's cheesy, let go and let God in a certain way, but there's a depth to that, you know? I think of a wholeness to that, actually. It's just accident that salvation, the Latin roots are health, wholeness, shalom. Like we enter into a space of ever widening grace that is deeper and wider the more we go into it, and that is a kind of surrendering.
Yeah.
Well, I would love to ask a thousand more questions, but I want to draw it back to this idea of cult of normalcy that you really address, and a sense of, and so maybe, I don't know how much we can unpack in the time we have left, but one thing we've heard in the previous episodes, whether it's with Swinton or some of the other guests that talk about, it's the body of Christ coming together isn't only about what we bring, what somebody brings, what they contribute through these sense. I mean, you mentioned the terms of efficiency and capitalism, but it's not just what we bring to contribute to the body, but there's a sense, and you draw it out with your discussions of Harawas and others in your work on reciprocity, and there's something in mutuality that it's not just in caring for somebody that they don't have anything to offer, but there is something theologically in the body of Christ with people who maybe don't contribute in the so-called normal ways of serving the church or serving people. So I'd like you to unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And often the language of gifts, you know, gifts are weighed and meted out as who's more important. And Paul sort of critiques that several places. But mutuality is a big word for me, and reciprocity. But reciprocity doesn't always mean, you know, an exchange where each party gives the same thing.
Can we really stop there for a second? Because I lived in Thailand for 6 years, and there's a word that doesn't translate into English that is grain jai. And it's this word that's kind of along with emotional. Jai is the word in Thai for heart, and grain, which would be an emotional like description to that, is not translatable. But it's the sense of if I give a gift to somebody, then they're going to give something back at some point equal to keep things in that truest sense of reciprocal. And there's times that if I do something too much or too little to somebody, they'll feel grain jai at me that I've either made them lose face or made myself lose face. And this idea of reciprocity in the world is not just this American sense of equaling out, is everybody getting fair share? But I think it's in many, many cultures, this idea of keeping it equal. And what you're saying, I think, goes way farther than other philosophies in this world.
Well, in fact, in the book, you know, economies of exchange is a term I sort of like, tit for tat exchange, where you owe me something, and then, you know, cultures of shame and honor, or in a capitalist society like we live in, you know, there's payment that's good enough for this. The economy of grace is something entirely hyper-capitalism we live in North America. A God that goes before us. It's no accident, before give. A God who prepares a way, you know, Christ goes to prepare a way over and over again. It's grace that's the priority. And how is grace meted out in terms of an economy of exchange, or reciprocity in terms of the ways we judge things and we give value to things meted out? And so for me, it's in the relationships of mutuality where there is some kind of exchange that happens. But I don't think it's an accident that Jesus throughout his ministry is saying, the face, you know, what are you doing to the least of these? I come to you in the least of these. And we meet the risen Christ in the face of a stranger who
please
is welcome with hospitality. And so it's...
I'm stealing from you right now, because I'm preaching next month at my church, and I'm drawing on that passage in Matthew 25. The least of these, the stranger, and I know Jean Vanier and others will unpack what stranger means in the sense of strangeness, in terms of disability, misfit, all these language. But this question, this somehow, some will read into that saying, well, when Jesus says you do this to the least of me, you do this unto, basically saying my family, that my brothers, my sisters, and he's connecting this to familial reign of God language. And I have trouble thinking that somehow if I'm going to offer hospitality to a stranger, I'm going to somehow have a criteria to know, oh, they're in God's family or not. Like somehow I can check, to be literal, their documents, to see that they're documented as God's people and not. And what God is saying is, as you do this to the least of these, you're doing this unto me. You're mentioning other passages as well in your mind, I'm sure, of how Jesus speaks of this. You do this to the children. You do this to the least of these. You do this unto me. You do this to the, you welcome these, you welcome me, you welcome. And yet we read this in such weird literal hermeneutics that we think, oh, we're serving only to the church. We only do it to people in the church. Then we're doing it to God. But I think there's something there that I don't theologically understand, how we're doing something to God, whether or not this person may or may not be part of the family of God.
Yeah, well, and that's the whole extravagant logic of hospitality that's in the Hebrew scriptures. It's there, you know, as you were strangers and I welcome you, God says, so you should welcome the sojourner, the stranger, the widow, and the orphan in your midst. over and again, this theme is God goes before, and God is a God of welcome. Yeah. And as a people of God, we're summoned into welcoming. And how do we receive that summon? By a knock on the door. And those inside don't have a list of, oh, do you meet the criteria? Because, you know, some entertain, like in Hebrews, angels, where they don't have a criteria. And the Abraham and Sarah welcomed, and they were blessed. What happens is the stranger, or the one, I like to think in some sense, who's made strange by normalcy, who's made other, who's deemed somehow unfit, it's the one who, in fact, my own sinfulness excludes, or systems that I participate in, like ableism, that do that, or racism, or all, you know, justice, injustice kind of situations that break relationships. Hospitality is a sense of, as welcome happens, the welcomer is blessed. The host actually becomes the guest. Yeah. There's a reversal that happens that, for me, is like the epitome of gospel. Just welcomes all to the banquet. In fact, it's all the rich people and the, you know, who don't want to come. And the others come, and it's a festival. I mean, that's a foretaste of this kingdom that we talk about.
Wow.
So that's why hospitality is big for me. Hospitality can become condescending. It can become pity in so many different ways that limit the imagination, you know. But when I see gospel, when I the good news, that is, of God with us, and the preposition "with" is key. It's a call for us, the church, to be with the world as Christ came. God with us, Emmanuel.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a super way to just... to use the language of maybe the previous generation, mic drop, millennials, this generation of me, but Mike, I think that's just a really good way to just drop the mic and say, Emmanuel, God with us. And the withness, which I know you use that language too, the withness as we are with others. I just want to say thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, wow. What a fun conversation. Thank you all. Thank you for the invitation. I'm going to write some notes down after some of your comments. That it was a good conversation.
Thank you. That's the most honoring, joyous thing we can hear.
Well, again, it's testimony. It's the conversation that really makes, you know, and we improvise together. Anyways, thanks for the time together. Yeah.
Yes, thank you so much. This was, I mean, you're talking about that you're going to write down notes. I've been writing down notes, little mental notes and physical notes. So thank you so much for being on the podcast with us today.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think that, sitting here, I'm also sitting here like, man, I want to write down notes, but I think I also just want to sit with God and say, okay, I want to grow, but I also don't want to be making this out to be... like a chore or something that I'm thinking my way through, but kind of want to just sit and really just be with God and re-engage in some relational aspects.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Me too. spiritual life isn't a box to check, right? It's not something to become efficient at, I guess, as we talked.
Yeah.
Something to let this...
Well, we just wrapped up our conversation with Thomas Reynolds, or does he go by Tom Reynolds?
Tom. Dr. Reynolds.
Dr. Reynolds. Oops, I'm using the way that Dr. Opie talks about him.
It's okay.
Oh, no.
It's okay.
But yeah, we just wrapped up our conversation. I think something that really, I think even like I'm just sitting and just thinking about is just really about just vulnerability, just in general. And how even like within the church, how I think sometimes we have a culture that can a little bit, I don't know, that can kind of be in some ways against vulnerability, against like being able to, I think, just be honest about our weaknesses. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think I'm just really just sitting and just processing all that he had to say about that. And just, I think, I don't know if he said this, but I was kind of reading like a
it's
book.
It's okay. What are you, what do you hear?
His book synopsis on Amazon, because now I'm going to buy his book because I really want to read it. But that how even talking about like our weaknesses are like invitations. And he talked about like how like disruptions are kind of invitations. And I just, even like that language, I think is just so powerful. So yeah, that's what I'm thinking about right now.
Yeah, really, really provocative, but thoughtful. It makes you, maybe we shouldn't rush to then say something after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really stood out to me, and it kind of even himself, like when you're engaging with being vulnerable, it's not something that is a negative, like kind of what you were saying. Mm-hmm. And then also like he had said multiple times that he had met in his own walk with his son failures. But those are ultimately things that you grow from, and it's not something that we need to hide from.
Yeah.
And then also kind of just like, again, like there's so much power in community, and that we can have a growth and trust and relationship with God, not only in how we approach with our own thoughts and understandings and want to grow and become more efficient, but also how we can sit and be in relationship and not striving to be the best, but also being open and mindful for what the Lord wants to speak.
Yeah.
And also having our eyes open for things that we maybe don't see.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Well, I think based on both of what you said, this word kept floating in my mind of the word masculinity. And I'll say it again, maybe you'll react. Masculinity. No.
I didn't react because I'm not a man. So I was like,
no,
cool.
You could have you, whatever reaction.
I wanted to hear where you're going with it, Andy. Yeah.
Well, there was a panel at Society for Pentecostal Studies on toxic masculinity in the church. And Joy Qualls, who teaches at Biola, and some others were interacting back and forth. And I think there's a sense where some are wanting to recover, like, that it's okay to be a man because there's been a strong critique against quote-unquote manliness or...
Yeah.
And so then Joy Qualls was like, well, there's the strong man, you know, this more of this metaphor, the strong man's the one who gets things done. But I was saying to her afterwards, I'm like, I don't know that the adjective is helpful, because I don't think masculinity is something we hear Jesus going around saying, hey, let's be manly men and let's be womanly women. And there are differences in some ways, but a lot of the gendering is socially constructed. And so even I'm reading Leah Payne's book a year later than when it came out, but her book on the history of contemporary Christian music. And 100 years ago, there's this language within Protestant churches of masculinity. We need, and then they talk about what it means to be manly, and we can go to Mark Driscoll, who's maybe not a great example of what it means to have masculinity, and we need to be more manly, strong men, and we've feminized Jesus, we feminized the way we sing songs in church, and I think it's really ridiculous to talk about this, because I don't think Jesus is out there saying be more manly. And I don't think that neither is he saying be less manly, but the way that Jesus embodies manliness, the way that Paul embodies manliness. I mean, Paul was critiqued because he wasn't manly enough. And they're like, we don't have to listen to you. Your rhetoric isn't the way that we understand masculinity. Your body is weak to look at. And so this idea of, being manly enough according to society is what is ridiculous. And so I don't think it's the answer isn't to be less something or more something, but masculinity, whatever that means, is usually engendered, imagined by a particular kind of thing as what is normal. And it comes back to that normalcy. And 100 years ago, the Evangelical Free Church or Christian Missionary Alliance, they'd have these pictures of word pictures of manliness and somebody out on the frontier with who's carrying a six gun and like, okay, so manliness means I can carry a gun and shoot a gun. I don't know that that's what it means to be a man of God. Now, that leads to a whole bunch of other questions, but what does masculinity mean now? And we could spend time on Mark Driscoll and other poor examples of abusing power in the name of masculinity. But I don't think the adjective toxic helps, because I think it's just the whole idea of we need to have masculinity strong, this or that. We need to be men and women of God. That's a different story.
Yeah.
But so I think that just helps us paint a picture of what does it mean to be normal. And so we use words like masculinity. Men need to be more this way. Women need to be more this way. This. And then we create these stereotypes of what it means to be a person, of whatever kind of person. Mm-hmm. And in that idea of masculinity is I'm strong, I can protect, I can this, and it leads to this autonomy of control of, and I think it leads us to more dark places than generative and freeing and gracious places. So that was a lot of what was running through my mind, especially based on the way you guys are reflecting on this. So I think there's so much to chew on.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't want us to just end there. There's so much to chew on, and maybe it just leads us to think maybe we can end just with like maybe one takeaway, one thing that we can say, let us lean into this personally or in our context of how we serve, where we serve.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, I think just leaning into more of just, I guess, the relational aspect of who we're all called to be. That even like thinking about it over the summer, I'm helping to kind of develop like a discipleship program here at LPU for students, and just thinking a lot about discipleship. And
wait, my class doesn't disciple enough? Are you saying there's a flaw in the system? Okay, sorry.
No, it's just answering a need that I know students have, but
for sure.
Even just thinking just thinking about discipleship, how really like, mm-hmm. you know, and like just studying it and just and really meditating on it. Yeah, it's done.
Knowing how you're working towards what you're doing. You're really
helping. In the context of community. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think leaning into more of that side. I know me personally, I think I can often go on this side of, oh, I can do it all and I can do it by myself. But really, as I've grown in the Lord and he's given me new callings and new assignments and new tasks, every single time it's a realization of maybe you can do it by yourself, but that doesn't mean that you're supposed to do it by yourself. Mm. And so I guess just leaning into more of that relational aspect. And yeah, I don't know. I guess that's a takeaway for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think what I'm sitting with kind of as a takeaway is a couple different things. Like the first one that comes to mind is kind of relinquishing autonomy kind of giving up. But I think one of the ways that is really kind of reflected as we were talking today was how do we choose what our metrics of value are?
Yeah.
And kind of shifting, because I think even as you were having a conversation about Rick Warren and mission and stuff, and even in that being in like how we think about who retains the power, I was also thinking kind of like who retains like the goals and what sets efficiency to be, is this efficient or is this not efficient, and even changing how we approach our values in doing church, in doing mission. And I think that there's so much beauty to you know what Dr. Reynolds was saying, where it's like sometimes what is best is to sit in silence and have our eyes open for the needs of our community.
Yeah,
and that is an extreme shift to a lot of things that you know a lot of people might have heard, myself included.
Yeah,
I'm gonna just tag on that, because John Cleese, our hero, yours and mine, Chandler.
John Cleese.
In his recent book that I've not read,
shout
but I've heard him talk about it. But the creativity and writing, like, because he's a writer, comedy writer, but a lot of times creativity takes a lot of getting up and walking around and doing something else that's totally unproductive to then finally have the thought to articulate. And I think the waiting, I don't like it. And then I feel like I'm being unproductive. And then I start feeling shame. And so to be in that space, that tension, to let go and to release control and let God be the one to give the spark to creativity. And yes, do the work I need to do and work, but don't be so bent on, I'm not writing enough in my writing, or I'm not fixing this enough, not getting this better enough. Well, this has been fun. We should probably let people come back another time. So thanks for listening. This has been fun.